Welcome to your Right to Speak discussions on child and youth rights and advocacy. This is episode 6, and I'm your host, Sammy D'Agostino. Today is an exciting day for your right to speak. We will be introducing Josh as my new co-host, and some of you listeners will remember Josh as being the person that I interviewed last, so it's very exciting. So welcome, Josh.
Hello. So just a little bit about myself. I am a student over at Ryerson for social work. I'm in second year, and I'm also a colleague of Sammy's at the Provincial Advocate's Office for Children and Youth.
So yeah, thanks again, Josh, for doing this with me. So today we are going to be talking with Jen. Jen is a current student at York University and I believe is studying psychology.
Yeah.
And Jen, can you please introduce yourself?
All right, hi. I am currently enrolled at York University for psych, as Sammy mentioned. I work at the Provincial Advocate's Office, and I also volunteer at Distress Centers, which is a crisis link for people who are having trouble with depression, mental health, or they're just feeling very isolated and lonely. I've been doing that for about over a year now, and it's been a really great experience.
Well, thanks, Jen, for taking the time out to discuss mental health with us. I'm just going to dive right into it. What is stigma? Can you define what stigma is? And I'll ask a follow-up after that.
Yeah, for sure. For me personally, I think stigma is a preconceived notion in your head that usually is very negative towards other people. So for me personally, I think you have all these ideas that either the media tells you, your friends and family tell you, your family upbringing, and it basically is a way you judge people, whether you realize it or not. And I think everyone is a little bit guilty of it.
Yeah, something I think I spoke of in my last interview is one thing that I very much dislike about the concept and idea of stigma is that do you find that there's often an individual focus of stigma that we think the preconceived notions tends to focus on that. That's when we tend to focus on trying to educate people, when really stigma comes from and you kind of mentioned it, institutions that create the space for stigma to exist. Do you agree with that? That there might be too much of an individual focus of stigma and thinking that it's just individuals that need to change?
I think I definitely agree with it. I don't necessarily put all the blame on the individual. I do think it is institutions that create it. Mm-hmm. So I agree with that, yes.
Okay. So my next question for you is, do you think social workers and CYWs and really any other type of people that work with children and youth stigmatize against young people who have mental health illnesses? And if so, what does that look like in terms of certain practices and actions?
I definitely do think they stigmatize people who, anyone with mental health really, I think is stigmatized against, even if it is with professionals. And I do think that's either the way you've been raised or just educated. I don't think you can fight that really currently right now. How it turns out, I think if you took a kid who people see has a mental illness and someone who doesn't, they're going to look at the kid who has mental illness a little bit differently and treat them differently. And you can hear that even just day-to-day conversation. When someone does something that you don't like, oh my God, they're crazy. Oh my God, they're bipolar. They're acting schizo. And those just slip out and you don't really know what even any of those means. So if that's being dropped in normal conversation, then yes, I think when you are dealing with mental illness, you treat people differently, especially when you know they have them for sure. I'm not 100% sure how it's carried out in social work. I think kids and youth and adults who do have a mental illness kind of have to fight a bit more. I know you can't mention it really, I'm bipolar. I would never in my life mention that in a job interview first getting one. Even though I'm in the field where it's social work and I'm volunteering, I'm doing all this stuff, I know people will look at me differently or, oh, you're depressed, and they don't want to touch it. It's dangerous almost. So I think they get treated differently and not in a good way.
I find the same thing with like my disability as well. I often don't disclose that on a job interview too, because you do get treated a bit differently,
yeah.
And like how you're seen and the type of work that's given to you is very different compared to what society sees as like normal people.
Yeah, exactly. They're worried you're almost gonna go off the wall. And like I remember just a normal conversation with someone and they're describing this fight that their mom was in, and oh, there's just some crazy bipolar person. I'm like, okay, I'm definitely not telling you I'm bipolar because I know you have something against people who are bipolar, just the way the tone of voice was and stuff. So, and if you have a bad experience sometimes, like if you're working in that field, say you're a social worker and you meet a child who's schizophrenic, you might apply their symptoms to every other person who you find out has schizophrenia, and that's not the case. There's similar symptoms, yeah, but every individual is different and they need to be treated as such.
Well, and something I've learned taking like disability issues courses and mental illness courses is that a lot of people actually don't like the term mental illness. And a lot of people have been using the term like mental differences to recognize that people are different and some people do need to be treated differently, but in a way that of course is not like differently bad. That like I'm going to treat you differently so that way you can do your job and do the job that you want to do. And like for example, just like the schizophrenia thing. So something that I've learned in a lot of like courses related to race is that labels like schizophrenia tend to be focused on, you know, racialized individuals, and it's been used to kind of like institutionalize them. So do you think there's that sometimes like diagnoses are kind of used to sometimes put people in a box and not have to deal with them, rather than like, you know, let someone be different and us have to change and let them be part of society? Like, do you know what I mean by that?
I think, okay, that one's tricky. I definitely think once you put, it's dangerous to sometimes put that label because it does put them in a box and they are forced to act a certain way and whatnot. I don't necessarily know if I disagree with, I do believe though that for me personally, I think people need to realize that mental illness isn't just a difference. It's not something that somebody can control. I know a lot of people who sometimes when they get diagnosed, they think it's their fault, or their family or friends get really frustrated. Like, why are you acting like that? And why are you doing this? And just stop the way you're thinking and stop it. And you can't. They've done brain imaging studies and it basically boils down all to your brain chemistry and it being out of balance. And they still don't fully know everything and understanding. They're getting closer. But it is, mental illness is something physical. It's in the brain. And you know, I wouldn't look at somebody who has cancer to, well, stop throwing up from your chemo, stop doing this. Someone who has a cold, I'm not going to tell them that because they're ill. And I think people need to realize the fact that people with mental illnesses can't always control their actions and behaviors because it is something that's physical and it is an illness. So.
Well, and I think like the term mental differences is used by people who recognize that. So they tend to use the term mental differences and the fact that like, they say that people are different. Mm-hmm. Some people need access to certain things, some people don't. And what they're saying is that the people that have that require access shouldn't be treated less than.
I agree with that. Yeah,
that's the point of the term. And that's why they don't like the term. And the people, like the folks who have been using it, typically those from disability justice movement, don't like the term mental illness because the term that like you're sick and that like, then therefore we have to fix you. Because the reason why the term came out was because then there's an assumption that there's a standard level of happiness that everyone has to meet. That there's a standard way of being functional that people have to meet. And so that's why they said, well, no, like that's not true. Because I'm sure if we tallied everyone at one point in time, like so many people would be in a very different mental state that we would call normal people. And so that's why they said, well, then there's mental differences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
So we've been talking about stigmatizing within the mental health community quite a bit. How do you think, Jen, we can resist stigmatizing young people who are members of that community?
Well, aside from like education on mental illness, like I think that's important, but I don't think that always solves the problem. Education in itself is not enough. I think people who are working in that field themselves need to have more training and not just, oh, these are the symptoms and this is the diagnosis and this is the medication. I think they need training on active listening skills and how to be more empathetic towards them and maybe even just have a normal conversation. Like, when you talk to someone who's mentally ill and you already have this preconceived notion, you're not talking to them like a normal human being. You're asking them questions where you're looking for an answer that they're going to give you, and you're not letting them show the real you, if that makes sense. You're kind of directing them to answer a certain way, and you're surprised, like, then you're not surprised when you get the answer you're looking for. When you talk to someone negatively, they're going to have a negative response, and which is what I feel sometimes people do when they talk to people with mental illness. So I think more training for sure, definitely towards active listening, empathy, and just maybe even meeting people who have mental illnesses who aren't going through a crisis at the time. I think when you constantly are bombarded with people who are going through crises, that's all you're going to see, and you're not going to see the good side of people who have mental illness, like their steady job and they have a family or they have friends and they like this sort of genre of music and that sort of deal. Like, I think people should see the positive side of people, if that makes sense.
I think that's a really good point that you made at the end of actually, like, meeting people that are part of the community and, like, actually seeing who they are as people beyond the label, right? Because I feel like a lot of the stigma does come from, like, the media and stuff, right? And it always, in my opinion, portrays people part of the mental health community in a negative way.
Yeah.
And so workers, without meeting young people that are community members, will they go into the field having already have that stigma from the media. So I think that's a great point. You mentioned earlier about active listening. Can you re-clarify like what active listening is and what that looks like?
Before you jump in, I just quickly want to point a finger. I do want to say, though, like, while we say that these ideas come from the media, I think we have to recognize that the media got these ideas from someone else, and that's usually government institutions and medical institutions. So I think that tends to happen is you say, well, the media puts these ideas out, and then, well, it's actually the same institutions that we're sending these people to for help that are creating these ideas or did create historically these ideas, and then the media continues to perpetuate them, and these institutions such as government offices and hospitals and services reproduce these ideas. So I just want to touch on that as well.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So yes, about the act of listening, can you re-clarify what that means for our listeners? Or
yeah, for not sure. Everyone knows. Just something. When I started volunteering at the distress centers, they have very like intense training. And the main thing they taught was active listening skills. So for me, not just on the phone lines, but I use it basically every day almost now. Like, you know, whenever I'm talking, I try to apply those skills. But it's basically validation. So you validate the person you're talking to and their feelings. Normalization, like, no, if you have this and you got into a fight and it's understandable you're depressed, that's normal to feel that way. Like, because it's everyone is different and that's okay. You should be entitled to those feelings. It's normal. And definitely clarifying, because sometimes I feel like people don't take the time out to make sure they fully understand what someone's saying. They'll hear the sentence, but they might misinterpret it, and they don't bother to go and clarify to make sure. And I think that's really important. Communication is definitely key to, you know, making sense of what's going on and helping someone. Just being empathetic, I think, is a part of it. I don't know. There's a bunch of tools like that for active listening, and I can't really list them all right. But I know on the phone lines when I talk to people who are going through a crisis, or if I'm talking to my friends or family, and I notice when someone applies those tools to me, I really appreciate it, and it makes me come off a lot more clearer, and it's better for problem solving and just exploring different options when someone's having a problem. So, granted, like, I just volunteer and I only talk to people for maybe like half an hour at a time on the phone lines, but it seems to really help them, and I hear from all the callers who appreciate everybody who's volunteering that it really helps. So I think applying those to other fields and other workers, it would be really beneficial.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think active listening is a major piece. I don't know if you agree or not, Josh, but
I agree.
Often, at least for me, I find in society we put a band-aid or excuse me, or have a short solution into working within the mental health community. Do you think this is true that there's this like band-aid solution?
Oh, and definitely.
Okay then. So how do we move away from that then? How do you think we can move away from?
There's a few things. One is I think prevention is definitely key. So if you come from a family or a background where there's mental illness, I think you should be more aware of things you're getting yourself into, stress. You know, maybe avoid doing, like, you know, if you're a teenager, it's hard not to experiment with different drugs, but, you know, if both your parents have mental illness, you might want to be careful with that. So I think for sure prevention. And another thing too is it's, a lot of people don't necessarily deal with it right away. So, cause they're scared to. So they wait until they're in crisis. They go into the psych ward. Psych ward takes a look at them, keeps them in there until weeks. Couple weeks maybe, gives them a drugs, ships them back out. As soon as, because there's not enough space, there's not enough beds, they're not going to really properly take care of you. As soon as you reach not as dysfunctional level, you're gone and you're back wherever. Or you see it a lot in jails. There's a fair amount of people in jails who all have mental illnesses because it's just a cycle. You go through a crisis, you do something, some criminal activity, they send you to jail and they kick you back out, and it's a vicious cycle. So I think prevention for sure, and long-term therapy as opposed to just medicating someone and just giving them short-term therapy until they're slightly a little bit better and then just kind of abandoning them. Like, that needs to stop. People need long-term care, and it can't just be strictly on the mental illness, because it's affected by everyone's life. So if you have problems at home, or if you're having financial struggles, or if you're having problems at school, and that all adds to the stress, it's going to worsen all the symptoms, and it's just going to be a vicious cycle.
So you mentioned, there's a few things that I kind of want to tease out of you. So you had mentioned that, like, to fix these band-aid solutions, we need to provide these services in terms of mental health. But one thing that I've learned is that a lot of mental illness or mental differences or mental health related issues come from stress. And so it's been, a lot of studies point out that, you know, racialized individuals, specifically who live in poverty, and indigenous peoples, all are showing higher rates of mental illnesses related because of, you know, stress and the situations that they're in. So you say that, like, also, and this is probably the reason why the government's not so great at it, we would have to address all these other issues as well in order for mental illness and mental health to really, I guess, not be resolved, but for there to be a better situation for these people.
Yeah, of course. Some people, mental illness, like for a lot of them, it's something that's passed down in the genes. Mm-hmm. So some people have these light switches, mm-hmm. and those light switches get turned on depending on the environment. Mm-hmm. Some people who I feel didn't have that stress in their life, that light switch would have never been turned on. They would mm-hmm. have never had an episode. They would have never had depression. Yeah. They would have, you know, whatever it is that they have, that switch wouldn't have been turned on. Mm-hmm. So definitely, the government has to help when it comes to poverty or whatever issue it is, they definitely have to do something. And because I definitely think it worsens the symptoms. Mm-hmm.
So then going off of that, do you think that there are enough resources offered to people that are part of the mental health community?
No. Okay. Definitely not.
So can you elaborate on that? Why not? What resources do you think should be included that are lacking?
Well, for one, it's expensive. Like, it's ridiculously expensive. Either you need medication, and that costs a lot. Therapy is over $100 an hour for some psychotherapists, or cognitive behavioral therapists, or whatever therapy you choose. There's the whole, like, the waiting. Like, I found when I went into the hospital, I was misdiagnosed, so I couldn't get back to the hospital because I was done being manic, and then I got severely depressed. and I had nowhere to go because my family doctor didn't want to prescribe me anything, because if I'm bipolar, you can't just put me on normal antidepressants. So I go through CMHA, and it probably took 2 months before I saw a psychiatrist and before I got medication. And I'm not the only one, and I was one of the ones who was lucky who got in fast enough. And I have people who call me, like I said, on the volunteer things, and that's the only thing they have. The only thing they have for support is calling us for half an hour and nothing else. They don't have therapy. They can't afford the medication, and they can't get into this program because they're too old, or they can't get into this program because they can't drive a car there. Like, just simple stuff like that you don't necessarily think would be a problem is a huge problem. So easier access, more psychiatrists, more mental health, and it needs to be covered. Mm-hmm. Like, I still don't understand why it's not covered.
And I find it so funny that you say that, because the government will be like, what are you talking about? We funneled millions into these services. And it's like, well, you funneled millions into people's salary.
Yeah.
And you funneled millions into research projects when people aren't saying, yes, we need research. Yeah, definitely. However, there are so many people that need services now, and they're like, oh, well, we also want to figure out, you know, the beforehand, but they're spending so much money on that.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so funny when the government comes out and they're like, no, we're taking a stance with this, and we're going to solve this. And it's like, well, start putting the money where it's supposed to go, to the people who need it.
And like, I also find that like the rest of society sees that mental health has enough resources because there's that view that the government is pouring the money in, and there's all this awareness, you know, there's the Bell thing, that Bell Talks, I think it's called, and all that stuff, right?
Once a year.
That once a year thing, but I think it just feeds into people thinking that these there are enough resources, and the community already has enough, and money should be allocated somewhere else.
Yeah, or even like that Bell Talk thing is such a big issue because what happens is people then only think about mental health once a year, and they think, well, I did my part. I what do you talk about? I hashtag Bell, let's talk, and then here we go.
Yeah, Josh, I agree with you 100%. So I do have one more question for you, and Josh knows what this question is because I asked him the same last question during the interview, and I hope to continue on this tradition with Josh with asking this question. I hope he doesn't take it away from me. What does advocacy mean to you?
Advocacy to me is helping someone help themselves. I don't think someone should like take all the control or do something for someone. I think you're just giving them a toolbox to let them use the skills that is already there. So that's what advocacy is for me.
I think that's a great way to end our conversation. I just wanted to thank Josh again for being part of this, and thanking Jen again for taking the time out to talk with us about mental health. I think it's a very important issue that needs to be talked about, and I hope the listeners continue to talk about this conversation. So would you like to add anything else, Jen, before we end off?
Just thank you for having me.
Thank you. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again, Jen, for taking the time out. If you are a child or youth and would like to be on the show, or if you think we should be talking about a certain topic, please email me or Josh at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That is yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.